You're listening to the Podcast Detroit Network. Visit www.podcastdetroit.com for more information.
All right. Welcome to the Beer Tour Guys Show, episode 20. Look at me yelling right into the mic there. Okay. I'll get my levels a little better here in a second. So how exciting, 20 episodes. And here we are on a beautiful Tuesday in the winter. And I got a great person to talk to today as he's pouring some beer. That's what makes him a great person, because he's pouring some beer for me right now. And I'm excited to kick it off here. So I got Robert Rodriguez, if I say the name correctly.
Yep.
I just want to say Rob the Brewer all the time, because that's your tag on Twitter, correct?
Yes, it is.
Yeah, I
Twitter
like that.
Twitter and Instagram.
So that's what I kept saying to everyone. I'm like, I got Rob the Brewer. And they're like, who? What? You know, like, there's all kinds of brewers named Rob. No, Rob the Brewer on Twitter. That's all that matters, really.
Exactly.
So cheers.
Hey, cheers.
Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
We're going to have some fun this hour. We'll get into a little bit of your background, what we're kind of starting here. What are we starting here with?
So we're starting with our barrel-aged VJ Black. So it's our VJP that we barrel-aged for 1 year and then bottled it.
Super
so we
smooth.
Also got some kegs too.
And what makes it a little better is it's a little more room temperature, which makes the flavor come out a lot better, I think.
Yes.
A lot
I
of
agree.
People sometimes pop these out and then it's like super cold. And I'm like, ooh, wow, you really miss something in the taste when you do that.
Yeah, definitely. When it warms up, it opens up a lot of the other flavors. And as it continues to warm, you'll open up additional flavors that you would not normally get. When it's about room temperature or even cold, we'll have different flavors. So
I'm warming up, put it that way.
So
like right away, I'm warming up with that. That's a good way to kind of kick off a nice hour talking about beer here. So let's like kind of go back a bit. Why don't you give me, you know, we know each other a little bit from your former employer at Traffic Jam and Snug, where you were brewing for, I don't know, what, a little less than a year there, a year?
Just under a year,
yeah. So we met there, but I didn't know a whole lot about your background. So let's talk a bit about your background, what got you into the industry, where you kind of came from since you're a newbie to Michigan. Let's talk about all that. You can start wherever you want in that statement.
Yeah, so I was actually born and raised in Greeley, Colorado, so northern – about an hour north of Denver, went to school, got a undergrad degree in in criminal justice.
Whoa,
worked in a halfway house for about 6 years, counseling people that were transitioning out of prison or trying to avoid going to prison. Went back during that time.
I'm definitely trying to avoid prison, just for the record.
Went back and during that time got a graduate degree in counseling, started looking for jobs in schools, and did an internship for a year in a middle school and a high school. Liked working with the kids, so I continued to look. But I knew somebody that was opening a brewery. I was tired of dealing with the halfway house, just the whole negativity about that. And
seems like that'd be a hard grind doing that.
It is.
I mean, hats off to people who do it day in, day out, right? That seems like it'd be very difficult.
It is. It's. I went in with great aspirations thinking that I could influence people, and it was all adults. And what I had to say, they didn't want to hear what I had to say and like provide guidance. So it wore on me and had to get out. So I knew somebody that was opening a brewery. While I continued to look for jobs in schools, started off as their first brewer at Cocapelli, which is in Westminster, so just outside of Denver.
If you say so, okay.
So Cocapelli Beer Company was the name. Helped them open. I was their first brewer, started out when they were still doing construction, tearing down walls, installing pipes, helped laid out the brew house and
the brewery. Okay. There.
Yeah, hands-on. So got in, got lucky, and started out as their first brewer. About a year later, I moved to somebody else that I knew that was on a little bit larger scale, more production, but still in around 1,000 barrels a year, Big Choice Brewing, which was in Broomfield. They have recently moved into a old Buddhist temple in Brighton, Colorado.
Well, that's pretty unique.
Yeah, it's a really cool place. So we're real close friends to this day, Nathaniel and Andrea Miller. And a lot of fun. And then I'm like, all right, time to take it to the next step. So started applying from coast to coast. And even though I'd only been doing it for 2 years, I'm like, go big or go home. So applied for head brewer or director positions. And I was given the opportunity to work for Two Brothers, which is a Chicago-based company. So
yeah, full disclosure, I lived in Chicago for 10 years, and then I lived in Lyle and Naperville for part of that.
Yep.
So in the just say a while ago, we'll use that as my answer. Anyway, very familiar with them in their early years. Mm-hmm. What, Warrenville, right?
Warrenville and Naperville.
And Naperville, that's right. Oh, yeah, because they picked up that other location that used to be the Walter Payton's like Roundhouse Brewing location. Yep. See, that tells you that I'm a little older. I actually have so back in the day, I was on a date once at when it was still owned by Walter Payton, while he was still alive, and Walter Payton came up to my table. It was like a Saturday night. I'm there on a date, having a beer, this really cute girl. And Walter Payton came up, and he was dressed super nice. He was a really sharp dresser, right? Came up and asked if he could kiss her on the cheek. And it was so funny. I was so thrown back. I'm like, sure you can, right? Like, I barely know this girl. I'm like, sure you could kiss her on the cheek, you know? She's like, your girl is so pretty. I'm just like, okay, you know. So anyway, somewhere, this is before cell phones, so it kind of sucks because I don't have a picture where it should have been like, you know, the three of us, me and this girl whose name I don't even remember, but she was a real cool person. Anyway, so eventually Two Brothers bought that location then.
Yeah, they've owned it for quite a while.
A while now, yeah. Like sometime after he passed away, the family sold that off, and it's a great location.
It's gorgeous, and there's a hotel. So when I got hired on –
it's a casino down there.
Yep. Yeah. So that was actually in Aurora. They've now got, I think, 4 locations in the Chicagoland area.
I didn't realize that. Okay. So, I'm actually going to Chicago Friday for a cider festival. So.
Oh, sweet. Yeah. So 2 restaurants and then 2 breweries that have restaurants in them. So yeah, they flew me out. It's a 70,000 square foot event center that has, I think, 4 bars.
Wow.
Yeah. So they hired me to do R&D brewing in Scottsdale, Arizona.
Okay.
So I moved to Scottsdale. I was there for 2 years. A year after I moved, my wife moved to Detroit, and she works for Quicken Loans. So we're like, all right, let's see, which city we like the most. I would come here and visit her, as much as I could, not nearly as much as I wanted to, but
that's a lot of work doing that.
It was a lot easier when I was in Arizona and she was in Colorado, because that's only a couple hours, a couple hundred bucks to get around, but definitely increased the cost to fly back and forth and the time.
So, oh yeah.
And then started, you know, we actually met at a beer fest. So Celtic Festival, pouring beer together, about 6 years ago now. So yeah. So the heat is a big thing. It's, you know, a week at a time over maybe even more, over 118.
Oh my gosh, that's crazy.
Yeah, and everyone's like, oh, it's a dry heat. Well, so is fire. Yeah. it's kind of like living in an oven.
Right.
And so she was trying to get down there, but she ended up with a position that she wasn't able to transfer. So I gave them notice and drove across country with whatever fit in my car.
Whoa, wow, really? What kind of car?
Subaru Forester.
Oh my God. Okay. Well, it's not that small, but still.
Yeah, it's only boxes.
Right?
So the only thing I could fit in there were boxes. So,
man.
It was fully loaded and moved across country. So got here, started working at Granite City, bartending, working a little bit in their cellar.
Which location? The one in Detroit?
One downtown, yeah.
Okay, Rensen.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yep. And then about 8 months ago, started working for Traffic Jam and Snug.
Michigan's first brew pub.
Yep. First brew pub. First recipe was from like 1993. I actually found it, and that was the first recipe that I did, and it was released right around that 25th anniversary for them.
Okay.
Yeah, so it was just a pale ale.
The 25th of Bruin anniversary.
Right, yeah.
Which is, just so people know, they opened in 1965, but as the first brew pub in Michigan, they got that license in 92, depending on how you look at it. And 93, I don't know. Some people probably play with what that means, right?
Yeah.
The law changed in 92, I guess I'll say it that
way.
Yeah,
and I think, I think they got the licensing and started working on other things.
They did,
mainly
yeah.
Mainly getting equipment in there.
Totally, right? Like, where do you get equipment? You know, yeah. People forget that when these first breweries like Traffic Jam open, it's not like you had fabricators down the road that you could just order up stuff from. You had to figure it out. Just like Motor City Brew Works across the street. And a lot of those early 90s breweries, they all had to do that. They had to figure out old dairy equipment, repurpose things. And that's totally what Traffic Jam did. That's kind of what you were – some of which you were working with while you were there.
Yeah. Traffic Jam actually still uses dairy tanks for fermenters, an old milk pasteurizer for their boil kettle, and good old trusty Grundy's for their bright tanks.
Yeah, what a learning curve. So that must have really changed up from what you probably had some experience with to going in there, would you say?
Yeah, a little bit. It's because the fermenters are open and they still make milk – or not milk. They make cheese in there.
Right, because they're a licensed dairy. Yep.
So we had to come up with ways to make sure that when other brews were done, grain dust wouldn't get in and cause infections. So we figured out a way to do a seal on the tank and prevent any of the infections coming in while they were doing cheese or while I was doing another brew.
Did you become a fan of their cheeses from working there? I would think you would.
Yeah,
I can't tell you how much of their cheese I've had over the years. It's probably too much. But it's a lot.
Yeah. My favorite from there is definitely the Blue Asiago.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Mm-hmm. I have customers say that to me all the time. It's pretty delicious. Much every tour. That was one of the early things when we started working with Traffic Jam for Motor City Brew Tours was, hey, how can I incorporate cheese with your beer into what we serve people? So we always get this cheese tray. You don't always see it when I was bringing groups in of what I always had, but it was like cold sandwiches, a cheese tray, and then your beer or whoever's beer. And it was a great compliment. It was a good story to tell, that kind of mix, you know, although it was definitely, I'm sure, a learning curve of you getting in there looking at all that. But, you know, wow, what a different experience.
Yeah. And fortunately, the experience that I had was I was able to put to good use to create process flows that it's like, all right, instead of having all of these extra parts, just simplify it so that you're throwing a few valves instead of moving around 12 hoses.
Right.
So actually, I also was the first brewer for Two Brothers. So
I
helped them get that place established.
Interesting.
Yeah. So I've.
And then the earlier places you're helping with construction, you really have a wild background now. What a varied background for just so, you know, not in the scheme of life, not that many years experience in it. I don't mean to belittle it that way. I'm saying like, oh, I worked 30 years for Chrysler, or I've been brewing for X years, but you've already done like a whole slew of things that you can kind of bring to each next step you're on. How fun is that?
It's great, and it's interesting how much I have pushed myself to learn and the knowledge. I'll just throw things out, and I'm like, where did I even learn that from?
Where did that come from?
You know, I mean, I've been fortunate. I've got great mentors that between three of them have probably 60 years experience together.
Oh, wow.
One of them's she's the R&D operations manager for Boston Beer Company.
Those guys.
I've got another mentor that just recently opened his brew pub in Wisconsin.
What's that called?
Inventors Brew Pub.
Okay. Where's that out of in Wisconsin?
It's just north of Milwaukee. I don't remember which city. And then I've got one guy that has been in it. Actually, I think he's been in it at this point for almost 40 years.
Whoa.
And yeah, so I've just been fortunate. And when I got into home brewing, I was like, I'm bored of beer. I want something unique, something different. So I got a kit for a Christmas gift, and first thing I made was a vanilla porter, and then I went straight into a caramel apple pale ale.
Well, that's way different. Yeah. Caramel apple pale. I can't say I've ever had that.
Yeah, so it tastes just like a caramel apple with a beer.
Wow.
Huh. Yeah.
I would definitely try it.
I've been trying to figure out how to recreate it because I lost the recipe almost what I've been doing homebrewing for 10 years now.
Well, that's because you only had a Forester and you couldn't fit everything in there. I get it.
Yeah. So now I am working at Atwater at the location in off Joseph Campo. So right
in the original location, the main location or production, as we were saying before we started taping the show there. I never say it that way, but maybe I should start saying it that way.
Yeah, so I've been in the park several times, but yeah, I'm stationed at the production location.
Okay. Wow. So now you're with, I would say, the biggest brewer in Detroit, I guess, if you look at it from that standpoint. I lost my train of thought because this beer is so good. It's definitely giving me a quick little buzz here. I don't always start with something this good, but I would say that the first my first kind of go-to beer for Atwater was VJP. It probably is for a lot of people that get into Atwater. And it was because of the coffee, but because it was mild. Yeah. And I'd say, like, in today's standards of coffee fanatics coming into beer and brewing coffee beers, it probably seems tame to some people.
Yeah.
And it's actually why I still like it that way, because the ABV is not too high on it. The coffee doesn't have too much of a bite. And I'm not traditionally a coffee drinker. I don't drink coffee, but VJP was the first one I tried. I'm like, oh, hey, what an interesting way to try coffee. And usually what it'd be is I'd be doing a tour and Atwater would be like my third stop and I'd need like a boost, where I'd be like taking a caffeine boost, but instead I'd do it with coffee.
Yeah.
And that kind of got me into it. And that's got to be a big percentage of their business. I know you just started there. I won't ask you for every single stat about Atwater, because you look at me like, what are you doing? You know?
But the biggest ones are going to be the Dirty Blonde and then VJP. So we've got some depending on season. Like right now we're getting ready to release Wango again. So
that's been a pretty good hit, hasn't it? Wango. Yeah. And then you actually today you brought the Raz version of Wango. Yep. So that's like a new variant. I actually haven't tried it that way yet. So that'll be a good way probably for us to finish.
Yeah. I love the mango and raspberry. It's you get the mango flavor, ripe mango, and then you get a little bit of tartness from the raspberry. So
yeah, that's an interesting mix. Mm-hmm. That's pretty unique in the market too. I don't think I've come across anyone doing it quite that way.
No, usually it's going to be like just mango or just raspberry, but or just a fruit, a single fruit. But yeah, mixing them together, it's
In terms of recipe development with Atwater, does that occur at the main production facility, or are those things that might happen more at one of the other locations like Atwater in the park, or do you have much insight into that yet?
Primarily it's going to be done in the park or the Grand Rapids location.
Because they're smaller setups and they can kind of tinker and see what customers are going to do, as opposed to being at the production one and large system.
Yeah. Makes so sense. The big one is a 40 barrel system versus a 4 barrel.
Right.
So we can, if something goes weird or it's just not selling, it's not a loss. It, you know, 4 barrels,
the world's not going to end.
Exactly. Versus the cost of making 10 times that. So,
right.
Yeah. And, I actually just found all of the parts for the firkins. So I'm going to restart some of the firkins.
Oh, interesting.
So
are you a firkin fan?
I like firkins. Yeah.
I can't say that real fast.
Or yeah. Say it wrong, aren't I? Yeah. I love firkins. Cause you can take good beer and just put a little twist on it, and it gives a new dimension to something. So I'm gonna take the first one I'm gonna do is D-Light, and I'm trying to decide which chilies I'm gonna do, but I'm gonna do a honey jalapeno or a honey habanero. So a little bit of honey sweetness, and I think I might do like a buckwheat honey, a big bold honey.
Oh, interesting. So I definitely would enjoy trying that. D-Light, what a nice – I can't wait for days where I'm drinking D-Light again and it's warm out. Although today is kind of weird because it's still this odd, like it rained for a couple days. And what a weird couple of days here in Michigan. So typical of Michigan.
Yeah. That's one thing that I love about the state too, is it's a lot like Colorado, where it's cold and then the next day it's warm. It's just a lot more humid.
Right. Yeah. So you've had about a year? You said a year now here?
Yep. I've been living in the state for about a year.
Okay. So you've at least seen the four seasons worth of how Michigan is. And, you know, I've lived here my whole life. So although I have lived in Chicago for a while, but similar in seasonality. And you just you adjust for the seasons by living in a state like this, for sure. As opposed to like if you're in Arizona and it's just hot and then not as hot, basically. Where here it's like we all got, you know, different sides of the closet to go to at different times of the year.
Mm-hmm.
And especially last week with all the crazy, you know, polar vortex stuff going on and all that stuff. So
yeah, I've learned that I always keep a coat in my car, just a light jacket, because at least it's something. And then when I moved to Arizona, I had it in there. And I was like, well, this is useless. So I took that out and threw a pair of swim trunks in the back instead, which served a great purpose because I almost everybody has a swimming pool there.
Yeah, my brother-in-law lived in the Phoenix area.
Yeah,
Phoenix. He worked for the Diamondbacks for a while. So we made a couple trips out there. And holy shit, like everything you said was so true.
Yeah.
And it was so hot. And he had a pool. And he just said, everybody has to have a pool here. That was kind of his answer to it.
Yeah, you have to.
I was like, yeah, that does make sense. Even my sister-in-law, they live in where do they live? They're in Lake Jackson, Texas. Okay. And that gets real hot. Although I typically have only been there in the holidays when it's off season for that.
Right.
And it's kind of nice. And they think it's like so cold then. And I'm like, well, this is awesome. It's like 55.
Oh, yeah. I got
Christmas. You know,
I got looked at funny all the time because I'm walking around in shorts in the middle of winter, or what they call winter. And they're wearing, you know, big down parkas.
Oh, totally.
And I'm like, aren't you freezing? No, it's actually really nice out. It's like 60 degrees.
So at least your body doesn't have to completely adjust too much for Michigan.
Yeah, no. And I've got plenty of warm coats that I've kept. Big down Eddie Bauer parka. So
yeah,
that saved me last week.
Definitely need them here.
Yeah.
So do you still have a lot of family then in Colorado?
I've got my mom there. I've got some good friends there. My brother lives in Montana, so Bozeman. He's been there for about 10 years. So my godkids and his wife are up there in Bozeman. And then I got a pretty small family.
Okay.
My dad had a whole lot of people on his side, but they're all in Puerto Rico, so we never saw them very much and never got to know any of them. So, it's very small family. Now, she's got a lot of family that's still in Colorado.
Oh, okay.
So her brother, her sister, mom, aunts, uncles, cousins.
So you guys are making tracks back there then?
Oh, yeah.
For sure.
Yeah, definitely. And then, of course, for GABF, too. Can't miss that.
Oh, well, yeah, of course. Right? Wow. You know, I've never gotten to go to GABF. Can you believe that?
Wow.
It's just never worked. But it's part of being a tour operator.
Mm-hmm.
You sort of have to make decisions.
Right.
And I'm making decisions probably a year out. So I've kicked it around a couple times. Like, all right, this is going to be the year that I'm going to do that. And then I just haven't like made it work yet.
Just commit. It's first year that I've missed. So this past one is the first one in, I think, 8 years that I've missed not going.
Wow, that's pretty amazing. You've gotten to go that many times already.
Yeah, I mean, it's all but 2 years I lived in Colorado, so.
Sure.
And, you know, two brothers would send me back, so I'm definitely looking forward to getting back this year and hanging out with my friends. It's
Must be quite a reunion then.
Yeah,
to
I have
do
to
it that way.
I got to attend all four sessions because the first one, it's mostly, you know, beer people and industry people, and I'm getting stopped all the time to get caught up, and I'm like,
sure,
let's go grab a beer while we're chatting. So, you know, the first day, definitely it's more catching up, and then the next couple of days I can go and
explore.
Sample. Yeah, go and explore a little bit more. So
that's how the Michigan Brewers Guild festivals are for me.
Yeah.
Now that I've been a tour operator for 10 years and I know a lot of, you know, brewery folks or just customers.
Mm-hmm.
It was funny. It's something I hadn't thought about, you know, like I just had gone to festivals as an enthusiast for years. And then I started the company and started making friends and doing tours all the time. And then you'd go to a festival and then people were excited to see you that were on a tour a year ago, or brewers are excited to see you because you brought a group in or whatever. And then over the years, that just multiplies.
It does.
And then, you know, now if I go and I got a buddy next to me and then he's just like, yeah, I'm going to keep moving. You know, like that would always be his answer. Like you can sit there and talk to whoever just walked up to you, but I want to keep moving.
Yeah.
But that's part of the fun for me. I really enjoy that. I probably don't even drink as much at festivals like I used to because you're talking, and that's a good thing for my liver and for just, you know, keeping relationships going with people.
Definitely. It's
So what was the first Guild Festival you went to?
So that was actually like within a couple weeks of me moving here. It was the
Was that the
Eastern Market.
The Eastern Market.
Yeah, okay. So the Fall Beer Fest at Eastern mm-hmm. Market. Not this past one, but the one prior to that.
Okay.
Went and I was with Granite City at that point. So
I wonder if I met you at that then. Huh. Because I feel like I talked to someone from Granite City briefly, and you guys had something with Detroit Beer Experiment at that one. Or no. Maybe I'm just confusing it. It's funny how they blend together after a while, and I forget. And for everyone who's listening, Detroit Beer Experiment is like the collaboration with the majority of the brewers in the city of Detroit would collaborate on some theme or something, and they've done it for a few years here. And just this last year, Rob, as he was at Traffic Jam and Snug, brewed the Faygo one.
Yeah.
And all the brewers did something with Faygo. Yours was the Red Pop, the Kettle Sour.
Yep.
And I just served some of that to folks on last Saturday because I had a walk-in tour in Traffic Jam. So then I was telling all the story about it.
I think it's down to the last keg.
Well, that was what I told people. I didn't really know that. And then I'm telling the story, and everyone's looking at me, so they brewed this for the Fall Beer Fest, and they still have some of it on? Well, I'm sure it's just the last keg. I didn't know. And then I was just saying that. But it's the difference of a small brewery, though.
It isn't. Yeah.
That's really how it works. And I think everyone kind of got that. They're like, oh, I see.
Okay. Yeah, because brewpub licensing is very different. It's you have no distribution rights. The only thing that you can do is take a keg outside of the building to a Michigan Brewers Guild Festival.
Right, that's one of the four. That's it.
Yeah, that's it. So you can't sell kegs outside. You can't distribute. You can't have anything outside of the tap room. So, you know, you're brewing small scale and everything has to be sold on site. And, you know, sours are ones that don't sell the best everywhere. You
right,
know, the people that love them, love them. The people that don't tend to avoid them. But, you know, it's one of those that they're fun to do, and the Detroit Beer Experiment's definitely a lot of fun because it brings everybody together, but getting brewers together all at the same place at the same time is kind of like herding cats.
Oh, it totally is. Super hard to do. I'm always impressed when I see it pulled off, and I'm always like, wow, you guys actually did that.
Yeah, getting two breweries together is difficult. Getting – this year we had seven. Getting seven, not even a chance. So we all did it at our own respective locations, which is nice. So we can do it on our own time, not having to wait for anybody else.
Right.
And communicate and plan through email. And we did manage to get, I think, everybody together except for maybe one place. We did two meetings, and each time one person was missing. I mean, that's brewery life. You're going along planning, and then, something happens, so you got to adjust, and you know that's just how it works. So.
Yeah, I'm so used to that now working with breweries and owners and brewers and whoever else I'm trying to contact with. I've just figured it. Okay, that's just how it is, right?
Yeah.
Like I used to get mad for why don't people get back to me quicker or give me their time? And I'm like, okay, you know, everyone's being pulled in all kinds of directions, and that's just the nature of the business, and you have to kind of accept that and not take it like it's some personal thing.
No,
you know?
It's not. It's that, you know, something happened and we got to address it right now. And
you got to do it.
Got to do it.
You know, that's how it is.
Mm-hmm.
Right? How fun. Yeah, I had a real fun group on set. I had 30 people, which is a lot for a walk-a-tour. I typically try to cap them at 20, but I had a birthday party. It was this guy brought in 10 friends and his wife had turned 40. So it was a nice, maybe a little more educated crowd, I'd say. That understood it. And,
right.
You know, so I'm doing you, Jolly Pumpkin, and Motor City Brewworks, which is such an easy three pack right there. It's kind of a no brainer, but I almost had to boot them out of Motor City Brewworks at the end because we're upstairs in that area that's not typically open to the public.
Mm-hmm.
And they just wanted to keep hanging and drinking. Of course, I'm sitting back there serving them samples. And after a sample, I'm like, okay, you're going to have to go downstairs.
Right.
Right. Like, you got to move this. I got to go home. So,
yeah,
but we were having fun. It was one of those good days where like I come home, I'm like, that was satisfying.
Yeah.
You know, there's sometimes I do tours and come back and I'm just like, ugh, mm-hmm. You know, but this time was like the whole group was real cool and into it and wanted to hear, you know, Traffic Jam's history and, Jolly's and Motor City's. And then I seemed to be on, like some days I'm not totally on, like this was a day where I felt like I was on. and just throwing out stuff and you know, try not to swear too much and that kind of stuff, right? You know how it is.
Oh, yeah.
So, oh, this beer. I love it. We're going to have to crack open something else, I think. We might have to use another cup here.
So I brought and I ended up bringing another VJP variant. So this is the Bavarian Cream.
I like it, actually. I had it recently.
Yeah.
I think it's good. It's very smooth.
It's to me, it's a good variant, not super sweet, even with the extra.
Here, we'll just go halvesies so we don't get too lit up.
Yeah,
we can drive later. So they've done a few variants then of VJ now, right?
Yeah, so we've got
this is one of the more recent ones, though.
Yeah, we actually have a four-pack that is out and available. You can get the Bavarian Cream, the regular, a coconut, and a raspberry. Cheers.
Really? I have not seen that. Oh, my gosh. Okay.
Yeah, right now we've got the raspberry variant on nitro
nice.
As well. So.
Okay.
Yeah, so we've got quite a few. We've got a really good selection of our beers on right now.
I got to get that four-pack then. Jeez, I got to get on that.
Yeah.
What am I doing? Better finish this show.
Yeah, so.
I miss in the summer, like this past summer, I was doing one bike tour a month out of Atwater Brewery there. So it made me pretty regular. Like I knew everything that was going on draft and rotating through. I'm also able to buy to-go beer out of there, which I love getting to do that. And, you know, and I can usually get hooked up a little bit in that process because I just brought like, you know, 20 people in there, spent a bunch of money. They're all geeked. We're all geeked, right? And that's kind of the nature of the business.
Yeah,
and I'm not going to turn that down if someone's like, hey, you want, sure, you know, this price. I'm like, all right, I'll take some. You know, and I'm doing lots of other events or I'm doing stuff on buses where like I'll bring the first round onto the bus for free for people. And a lot of times I'll use Atwater for that reason because it's a solid price point in the marketplace. And it's there's just good. You know, I'm not trying to do high ABV. And I would say that's kind of the sweet spot, in my opinion, for Atwater, although that's not what we started with.
Yeah.
But that is the majority of the portfolio really is in that kind of mid-range of the ABV and and lower, which I like personally. I've kind of cycled in my life, and I'm a little older than you, I'm assuming. And I don't know. I don't automatically ask ages right away. I'll just say I'm in my mid-40s, and as I've gotten a little older, and I found that I like being in that 4, 5, 6% range of drinking beer. Not that I can't enjoy a nice barrel-aged beer. I can. I just can't enjoy a lot of it.
Right.
Like I maybe could in my earlier 20s and 30s.
Yeah, I love session beers just because you can have several of them and not be lit. I got into beer because I love the flavor profiles that you can create and making a meal – you know, turning something that you would normally eat into something that you can drink. And I mean, I started doing the Old Chicago World Beer Tour when I was 21. And
of course you were 21.
I was absolutely. Doesn't mean that I didn't have beer before I turned 21, but actually I grew up drinking. My dad would share his Guinness and Boston Lager with me. We didn't have any.
Wow, like, really? That's so rare to hear it said that way, right?
Like it's not. He didn't have Bud Light or any of those crappy beers.
So your dad had some good taste out of the gate.
Yes, he did. Yeah, so you know I was fortunate to start with that. And when I had my first Budweiser or whatever, I was like, oh, this is terrible. Like, what are you drinking?
So, yeah, I came of age, drinking age in the 90s when what we'd say micro-brew beers came out, right? But it was still, you know, hit or miss at that time. Yeah. I was just lucky enough that I went to Western Michigan and Bell's, and their tasting room opened up at that time, and I got to try theirs right out of the gate. And then it made all the other crap that I was drinking in college seem just so horrible.
Yeah,
but because that was what was mainly prevalent, it's different today because today you could get good beer everywhere.
And it's not – I mean you can find good price points on it. Yeah, it's going to be more – you know, you're not paying $12 for 30 cans of, you know, Natty Ice or whatever, but you're
my
getting –
stomach's curling.
I've never had Natty Ice.
Oh, that's a good thing.
Yeah,
that's a good thing. Keep it that way.
But, you know, you can get a 15-pack for, you know, 15 to – $20, so it's good price point still, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, that's the power of a lot of these sessionable beers that have come out they've kind of redirected some of that price point so that it's not automatically a $10 six pack. And that's fine for that part of the market, but you got other people that want it. Like I just had a, I was just up in Houghton Lake for a guy's weekend, 2 weekends ago, and I brought a 15 pack of Solid Gold from Founders.
Yeah.
And just a nice light beer. You know, I've done the same thing with Atwater Lager or Dirty Blonde. Mm-hmm. And those are at nice price points for that. They're nice kind of entryways into it. And if you're having those times where I knew I was going to be kicking back cans of beer like pretty yep. hard for a couple of days, put it this way, I didn't bring back the 15 pack.
Yeah.
That's and, you know, the, but it served its purpose, right? Mm-hmm. Like that's like a 4%-ish beer.
Yeah.
And you need to have beers out there in that category that are still have flavor to them that you can still enjoy. You know, I'm still yeah. supporting Michigan mm-hmm. by doing that. But there was a time when you couldn't have done that. So, like, it's a nice trend in my mind. Some people are totally against that, but I'm the opposite. Like, I think it's a great thing. I see how it brings new people into the category.
It does.
That weren't drinking any of it before because they thought it was all too expensive. Like, oh my God, how can you spend $10, $12 for a six pack or a four pack of like something amazing, right? They think you're nuts. But if they like something with a little hot bite and they tried an all day IPA right. or, you know, any of the many variants out there of session IPAs at those prices, mm-hmm. they're like, okay, now what else, right? And now they're going to start looking at stuff or go to festivals or yep. come on tours. And that's what you hope, right? You want them to come into Atwater. And you want them to start checking stuff out. That's exactly. why Atwater recently came out with the six-pack container you brought to their brown ale,
yep,
which
brown.
Is their first brown, which I find so funny that that's the name, right? And I really like it. It's a great brown. It reminds me of in the 90s when I mm-hmm. first got into craft beer, and it was a lot of browns and reds.
Yeah.
And then that kind of fell out of favor, and it you don't really see did. A lot of brewers really play with it, or if they do, they're hoppy interpretations of that.
Yeah, American style. This is definitely, you know, Atwater focuses more on European and specifically targeting German styles.
Sure.
Where the hop profile is not going to be in your face for a lot of things. It's going to be very good, high-quality beer that is going to be more approachable. And then, you know, we've got the ones where it's going to be the Wango where it's fruited or VJP where there's going to be, you know, coffee and vanilla. And then there's going to be other things in there that give it variety besides, you know, but it's a great place to come and try the Atwater Lager.
Right.
Or the Dirty Blonde or any of the other ones that are, you know, it's like, oh, do you have Blue Moon? Well, no, but we've got a better version of it, Dirty Blonde. So, you know, it's a great way to get into, especially if you're not, if, you know, you've only drank macro garbage beers before.
It's from doing bike tours with Atwater for like the last 3 years and lots of bus tours over the years. But when I do bike tours, when everyone comes in there, they get a burger and then one pint, right?
Yeah.
And it's fun because the list is varied enough mm-hmm. that I can go down the line of people. And, you know, I've been doing this long enough that I know, okay, I'm going to have a certain amount of people that want the lagers and the D-Light and, yep. and the Dirty Blonde. I got those people, right? And then I got people that like some darker beer, so now I can throw at them a brown or a VJP or anything on that side. Mm-hmm. I got the fruitier people, right? And then, of course, I got my hop heads.
Yep.
And then, you know, you have a Northeast IPA and a Session IPA and a regular – and a couple variants of regular IPAs mm-hmm. in there. And what's your double IPA? I can't even think of the name of that.
We haven't done that since I've been there.
Yeah, that's
so I started
– me saying that
year,
says
yeah.
– I don't remember a double IPA. But regardless, you still have that yeah. on the portfolio. And I could go down the list. And you've always had a good pale ale on there. And a good Pilsner. Have you drank the Purple Gang Pilsner?
I have, yeah.
Do you know why it's called Purple Gang?
The Purple Gang of Detroit.
Very good. Okay.
Yeah.
I'm just making sure I know you're still new to this fine state of ours. So I just want to assume you know all our history, but
yeah
good story.
I've done some research on different things, and that was one of the things that I heard actually a couple months ago. So I was like, oh, the Purple Gang. So I looked more into it. But
whole chapter of my book, Detroit Beer History, Brewing in Motor City, a whole chapter of it's about Prohibition era stuff. And Purple Gang kind of hit a lot of that.
Mm-hmm.
When I do my bike and brew tour in the city that's about Prohibition history, we actually go by an old haunt of the Purple Gangs, which would be down the road from the brewery.
Oh,
so
cool.
They used to have one of their headquarters sort of was just down the road from that brewery. And then there's an old tasting room that was a speakeasy that is literally like, I don't know, four blocks from where you're working now. So
they say. Is that the one?
No, that's a different one. Yeah. Oh, you know what? No, but it's not far from that.
Yeah.
Woodbridge Tavern.
Oh, okay.
And so anyway, like almost across the street from that was where they said was an office for the Purple Gang. But there's lots of these conflicting reports.
Oh, yeah.
You could go crazy like pinpointing them on a map. Eventually, I just pick something and then I tell their story from there and it works as good as anything.
It does, yeah.
But that whole area would have been where they were headquartered during Prohibition, meaning the Eastern Market and river area there was kind of their turf, all the way up to the bridge by Belle Isle.
Right.
So if you go to the other side and you go up toward Lake St. Clair, going further kind of north,
yeah,
that would have been like the Italian gangs in the city of Detroit. So, but the Purple Gang obviously was the most powerful gang to ever exist, and the Jewish gangsters, and there's lots and lots of stories. There's lots of books written about them. I read a couple of the books while I was kind of researching the background to do the bike tour, and over the years, I get different stories from people about other places that, oh, they own this, they own that. Always very interesting. Just shows the money that was flowing into our city during Prohibition. Mm-hmm. It's immense.
Yeah, it's that Prohibition era is just – it boggles my mind. I've done some research on it, and it's like, you know, either be a doctor or start a church, because doctors could prescribe beer and alcohol and churches could serve it. So it's like, huh, open up a bar, do it as a church. There you go.
Or better yet, do both. And when you look at the city and you look at where historic churches are in the city, you see a lot of historic bars. Or used to be at one point, maybe got bulldozed.
Right.
Yeah. So like if you did a historic church and bar crawl, if that is even possible, you would see it that way. And definitely in the city of Detroit, I'm sure most cities across the country were exactly the same way because of the way the laws worked, in that church attendance spiked so much during Prohibition because you could serve wine. Then chemists and druggists and doctors could prescribe alcohol, right?
Yep.
So what would you tell your doctor, you think, when you went to the doctor to get a bottle of booze? What do you think you told him? What was your ailment? What do you think?
I mean, take a look at the cannabis world now. I mean, I've got a headache. Yeah. I've got aches. I've got this. I've got that.
You got it. That was exactly what people said. They said, I'm having trouble sleeping and I'm having a lot of pain.
Yeah.
And you'd get a bottle of whiskey. So now today, the modern version of that would be you would get cannabis.
Yeah.
Interesting, right? I hear the correlations a lot when I'm on tours and we talk about Prohibition. People are like, oh my God, it's just like that with – you know, medical marijuana or marijuana in general. And I'm like, it totally is. It's the same thing.
Well, so the in the park is actually in an old church too.
Right.
Water in the park. They've got
a great building.
It is gorgeous building. And they've got some of the pews as benches still. So it's a really cool, great outdoor, especially if it's
I love the summer there. Yeah. Oh, man. Yeah. I've done a two bike tours out of there last summer. So we would start and finish from there. And then those were auto history. So we'd kind of go into where Jefferson North Assembly plant is on the edge of Detroit.
Okay.
And which, by the way, when that GM Poletown plant closes, that Jefferson North Assembly will be the last automobile plant in the city of Detroit.
Oh, that's disappointing.
I know. It is disappointing. Although it is a large, large, large property there that's on the border.
Hopefully they repurpose the one and start making trucks or whatever the next thing is.
That's my hope. My hope is if they don't, they're going to get some other players to come in there. And that has happened before in the city. We've had lots of this happen in Detroit. We're a city that's used to this.
Mm-hmm.
My dad worked his whole life for Chrysler. He's retired now. But I grew up understanding that concept. It's to someone who like lived on the opposite ends on the West – it must seem like, huh? You know, and then you come here and you realize so much of the economy is really tied to the auto industry
still
to this day. Short of Quicken, that is.
Yeah,
right
now.
that would be the big exception. How funny that that's where your wife's at.
Right.
And that would be the exception to the rule, right? Before Quicken kind of came into the city, our conversation was always around auto. And then Quicken came in and, you know, the Dan Gilbert effect and all the things that have changed the city and all the positive things that have happened.
Now there's a huge tech push. So beyond Beyond just Quicken. So, you know, Google's down here. Amazon's down here.
Microsoft, I think, has people here now, too. Yeah.
Yeah. We're Google's in the LCA.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
I'm a huge hockey fan. So I was like, I did some research on the LCA, and I was like, they have a whole hockey arena in the basement. I was like, that's really cool.
It's a pretty amazing design.
It is.
I'm not sure it's really gotten enough respect yet for how interesting the design is, how it's going, you know, under, basically.
Yeah.
To work in that space.
And then it goes even further down just for the extra, the practice arena.
Right.
And it's like, wow, just the use of space, and the inside of the building's beautiful as well.
How many times you've been there? Been there a couple times?
I've only been there once.
Okay, but I've only been there once.
We spent the first half, so we went for, we didn't actually go for a hockey game, which is the weird thing. So we went for a basketball game, spent the first half of the game walking around looking at things, and hit a couple of the bars, and we're like, oh, there's a craft beer bar here, and there's, which one did we go into? I don't even remember which one it was.
Is there a Goose Island one there?
There's a Goose Island, I think, like little mini tap, but they actually have a not Yard House, but something similar to that where it's all craft beer too. So
who would have thought we'd be going to stadiums and we'd be talking about that?
I know.
The Tigers were pretty early to the game doing that at Comerica.
Okay.
I can remember they had the Michigan craft beer section there, and that was years ago when they first put that in, like, I don't know, 5-6 years ago. When they first did that, I'd say that was a little bit ahead of its time. And Atwater was pretty early on, prominently featured at Comerica Park. I used to talk about it when I would give Atwater's history when I'd be down by the river location, Joseph Comp location. And I'd talk about, hey, if you're at a Tigers game, they're in section blah, blah. Yeah. And that was like when they were probably the first one to have better beer really prominent.
Right.
When I mean better beer, not featured by, you know, an Anheuser-Busch InBev or a Miller Coors, right? But like an independent.
Mm-hmm.
And they were pretty early on. It'd always be Dirty Blonde, D-Light, and probably VJP and something else.
Yeah, but it's the ones that are going to
sell the most
in
volume.
In the park, yeah. I mean, there's no sense.
It was exciting the first time I saw like the stand.
Yeah.
And that was like, this is years ago. I'll bet you this is 10 years ago. We'd have to ask Mark, the owner, like when they first got in there. But very early on, you know, now like you would just expect that and it just wouldn't seem so novel. But then you're just like, holy shit, I'm at a Tigers game and I just drank a good beer.
Yeah. I went to the football game, the last football game, I guess it was New Year's Eve, not 2018, but for the 2017 game. And so we walk around between the quarters and find the craft beer stand. And they have some of the crappy beers there too. And I'm like, $8.50 for a pint of real beer, $9.50 for a pint of shitty beer. How funny is that? That the crap beer is more expensive.
That doesn't even make sense.
No, it doesn't. And it's, I was like, sold.
Right?
Got it.
I'm in.
I mean, yeah. You know, $8.50 for us is pretty astronomical, but, you know, at a ball game or at a, you know, sporting event, that's reasonable, very reasonable.
I like as they were talking about the Super Bowl this week and they were talking about the stadium and how they had these fan-friendly pricing and they were making such a big deal about that at the Super Bowl. Now the stadium was so radical in their thought process of not ripping you off, you know. And
what
I'm listening to them.
$12 for a Bud Light?
And I'm just like, it's not really that radical, right?
No.
Like you just realize that eventually you raise the prices too much that, you know, over the years, like I just drink and eat less at sporting events than I ever used to because it's so expensive.
Yeah.
So if you lower the price a little bit, people are like, oh my God, I'm not 100% being ripped off. I'll buy more.
Yeah.
And then that's what happened. And they were making a big deal like, oh, they were so revolutionary. I'm thinking, no, they weren't.
No.
No, they weren't. It wasn't that revolutionary, right? It just made me laugh. I have a marketing background. So like when I hear stuff like that, I'm thinking, no, you didn't reinvent jack shit. Like you didn't do that.
Coors Field's been doing that for years. They've got the brewery, the Blue Moon Brewery right in Coors Field. And it's, you know, $7-$8. And they've been doing that for as long as I can think.
You know, I remember first reading about that. Now that I made all these comments about Comerica Park with Atwater Beer being there, I would say probably the Coors Field was one of the earliest ones to do that.
Probably. Now, and I mean, granted, it's owned by – it started by Coors, but it was a crafty bat, and it was from – I think the brewery opened in the late 90s.
Yeah. So that sounds about right. Maybe late 90s or 2000-ish.
Opened in early 90s. The brewery went in not long after, so –
They were a little ahead of the game in that respect. That's interesting. I would say Blue Moon was, you know, for most people, that would be their gateway beer in
a lot of people
to better beer. Mm-hmm. There used to be a Leinekugel's version of it too. That I think Blue Moon kind of just at the end of the day sold a lot more of it. It was like Sunset something. I don't remember what it was called.
Oh, Shock Top.
Well, no, Shock Top's Anheuser-Busch InBev.
Oh,
wow, I know it all. You know what? I just finished a friend of mine, Jerry, who listens to the show. Jerry, what's up? I saw him recently on a tour, and he let me read the book. It's like Barrel Aged and the Art of Selling Out or something like that in the title. And it's the story of Goose Island. And it was written by someone who was a writer, journalist for the Tribune. And I'm trying to remember how many pages. It was a long read book, and it had lots of information, but it was a really good read into, you know, if you think about it in the craft beer world, Goose Island was really the first well-known brewery to sell out.
Yes.
Right? To sell out to the big boys, Anheuser-Busch InBev in this respect. So the access this journalist had into the insights of what went on were, wow, amazing. I couldn't believe what I was reading in there. Like, I feel like I really understand it a lot more. And if you love local beer and you read that book, you would never buy Anheuser-Busch InBev again after you read that book.
Oh, okay.
It was funny. Right after I read it and finished it, I was at Costco. And you know how Costco works. You know, they'll have a couple of the big players in there, and they'll have a good price on them. So they'll typically have Bell's and Founders and maybe like Stone Lagunitas or Sam's or Sierra Nevada, some rotation of that in there, plus domestics on beer. You know, it's solid, the best prices you're going to see. Anyway, they will get Goose Island in there too. And I was amazed. They had two 15-packs shrink-wrapped together. So one was the 312 Urban Wheat that they're known for. The other was their IPA. And how much do you think they were selling the 30-pack for? 30-pack of 12-ounce cans.
$22.
Yeah, it was $24.99.
Yeah.
Crazy, isn't that? I was like, holy shit. So, you know, and usually their best deal is – you know, something like that in a case.
Yeah.
And you're excited. You're like, oh, cool. I got it all for $1 a can. I'm in for that. So here they've like undercut that.
Right.
And now they're in there doing it. And it's just after you read this book and then you see, okay, now I see things they're doing in the market. Mm-hmm. They've really screwed things up. I like to give the consumer, most consumers, the benefit of the doubt, but I don't know. I mean, money talks a little bit. And the Urban Wheat and the IPA, hey, they're fine beers for what they are. But because I lived in Chicago, I definitely had an affinity toward Goose Island in the years I lived there. But all those years were before Anheuser-Busch InBev bought them.
Exactly, yeah.
So, like, I lived at their Lincoln Park brew pub there. Like, just lived there. And that got me into, you know, craft beer a lot more post my college life. So it pains me to see stuff like that. Even this many years after that happened so long ago now when you think about it.
I was in Arizona when Four Peaks sold.
Oh, yeah, that's another one.
That was one of the most recent, and it's, you know.
Four Peaks was that Miller that bought them?
No, AB.
Oh, that was AB too. Okay, I get the two.
That was
the
year that the AB bought, I think, four. They bought Breckenridge.
Oh, that's right.
Four Peaks and 10 Barrel and somebody else.
It's, yeah.
Devil's Backbone. It's.
Oh, that's right. Yep.
But it's, you know, when they come at you with a check that's got nine figures on it, the first number is starting with a four or a six. It's kind of hard to say.
When you have to look it up and go, how much is that?
How many? You got to count. Like, ooh, that's challenging. Like, it's kind of hard to say no. Or Ballast Point.
Well, that was Constellation Brands. And they gave them $1 billion. I couldn't believe it when I read that.
Yeah.
It just boggled my mind.
And I saw a stat where it was basically the money that they made off of the sale of one of their products, or maybe all of the products, for the entire year. It was something crazy.
I just can't believe that. When I heard that number, I'm like, it can't be valued.
$1 billion. It was just absolutely mind-boggling how much they paid for it. But it's kind of hard to say no when they're coming at you like that. So,
but it's easy for me to be a critic of it because no one's coming at me with that money. So that's always sort of my cop-out. I mean, I get it. You know, I worked in big business. I worked for Kimberly-Clark, and I worked for a company called Velasys, and these were big companies, right?
Yeah.
And I got paid real people money for all that before I started a small business where I lucky to pay myself once in a while. And, mm-hmm. and I'm cool with all that, right? I'm not bitching. I'm just saying, like, I see it from both angles.
Yeah.
And it really depends on but it's interesting. Like, when you read the Barrel Age book, you could see that there were lots of mixed feelings at Goose Island. And like another example is I'm going to Chicago, like I said, this weekend, and it's CiderCon?
Mm-hmm.
CiderCon? Yeah, that sounds right. They're having a festival in Navy Pier, and it's all hard cider. My wife loves hard cider, so we're going to have a real fun weekend there. But out of that Goose Island deal, Greg Hall, which was the son of the founder, John Hall, right? He received a lot of money out of that original deal. He took said money and he started Virtue Cider.
Yep, I heard about
this. In Fenville, Michigan, right? Mm-hmm. So on the west side of the state there in kind of the wine region.
Yep.
And he did more European style ciders and drier ciders. Yeah, not fruit forward type of things like a lot of the other players in the state. And he did that, right? And who eventually purchased them? Anheuser-Busch InBev.
Yep.
So, you know, Virtue will be prominently displayed, I'm sure, at this festival. And there's lots of there's like a whole cider week going on in Chicago this week.
Okay.
Kind of that leads up to the festival on Saturday. And just like what we do everywhere else with it. We do the same thing in Michigan. And it's interesting. But it's funny because my wife knows all this, and my wife cares about local cider.
Yeah.
Right? Like I don't want to make a big deal about Woodchuck, but bigger company. She doesn't typically buy them. She's a fan of Blake's. She's a fan of Vandermill. She's a fan of, you know, lots of the other smaller players in the state. We're lucky that in Michigan, we have a lot of great hard cider makers. We really do.
You know, all of the cider mills, and a lot of them also make hard ciders. And it's like when I actually last fall, one of the times I came to visit before I moved out here, my wife's like, oh, let's go to a cider mill. I was like, oh, yeah, that's cool. So we show up and I'm looking for what I know is cider, not what I would, you know, before I moved here would call apple juice. And I was like, there's a difference between cider and apple juice? And
I think a lot of people don't know that.
No, there's a huge difference. I didn't know that. And I was like, oh, there is a huge difference between them. So, you know, I'm going thinking, oh, yeah, we're going to go to like a place that sells alcoholic ciders, and we're there and it's like donuts and gallon jugs of cider. It's like, oh, well, it's delicious. Not what I was expecting. But I like that there's a lot of them that do both.
Right.
Both versions of cider. So,
well, like Blake's is a really good example. You know, I grew up here and I grew up in the suburbs, East Side. And as a kid, we would go cut down Christmas trees at Blake's. And then, you know, it was a whole family thing. And
it's always fun.
So that's been, you know, a multi-generational farm there with this amazing business. Mm-hmm. And then, like, I think it's the third generation came back from college and said, hey, family, we should be making hard cider.
Yeah.
And then eventually Blake's hard cider. And this is not even, what, 5 years ago now, not even, basically.
Blake's is huge.
And now they're a large player. There's just an article out there recently about, you know, the growth of cider and the growth of Blake's and how many states they're in now. And, you know, they're the player, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's so amazing that, you know, I want to be behind them even more now because they're from Armada, Michigan.
Right.
And wow, you know, it's local, you know. But in the case of, like, Virtue, I don't feel that way.
Yeah.
Because I'm like, oh, okay, so he took that money he made from the Anheuser-Busch InBev deal. He started this thing, but then he had problems with it. When you read the book, you realize that Virtue wasn't really running that well. And then essentially Anheuser-Busch InBev came in and bought it out and kind of rescued him. And yeah, okay, so he's still involved with it. But at the end of the day, like, someone kind of bailed you out. And when you read the early years of Greg Hall, he really loved the beer world and did lots of beer dinners and talks and did all these great things and be a reason why you would have loved Goose Island because you probably met him at a beer dinner.
Yeah.
But then eventually they sold out. He took that check and did all this stuff. it's hard. It's like if you love local and then you see that happen, and then if you were born and raised in Chicago and were raised around that, you'd be like, oh, wait a minute. Okay. Now you could go to Chicago and there's just like Michigan, there's a slew of amazing small breweries that have popped up around that are getting –
Chicago's got one of the biggest explosions.
Yeah.
And LA's got a huge growth too because of the recent changes within the last year or two in both locations. About
a lot of it's legal things.
It is.
You know, and that those post-prohibition era laws, eventually they catch up and go, well, these other markets are making a lot of money. Why do we have some of these laws still on the books?
Yeah. The one thing I would love to see in not just Michigan but across the country is go to – like I like going to beer festivals and getting, you know, one and a half, maybe 2 ounces – and try 50 different beers, drink 50 ounces versus going and getting, you know, a 4 ounce pour.
Sure.
And, you know, like GABF, unlimited pours, but you get 1 ounce. That's enough to taste the beer. And that's kind of what I'm going for is I want to see if there's places that I want to like look into and be like, oh yeah, I really want to go to this state next year and do a tour versus, you know, going and getting a 4 ounce pour and, you know, you're lit after three beers, maybe.
It's a good insight. I wonder why more festivals don't approach it that way.
It's all legal. It's state. Arizona had that. Michigan's got it. It's all on that whole you can't give away a product. So the one thing I've noticed is to me, it almost incentivizes drinking because you get this token. And by the end, you want to use – and it's not just – like the Brewers Guild uses tokens, but there's others in the state and other states that they use punch cards.
Sure. I use punch cards for my beer tastings I do on Detroit Princess, which I'll do for the season, by the way. Anyway, I'm sorry. Continue.
So it incentivizes that drinking where you want to – the people feel the need. And I've heard it where they're like, I need – just here's what I have left. Just keep pouring. And I'm like, that's not the purpose of the beer festival, though. It's the purpose is to go and try lots of different things, not just go and get hammered on a beer.
Some of it's the culture of the state and the drinkers of that state, too.
Yeah.
But it's like, I know. It's a lot of work.
It is.
I think to change people's mindset. Like I was raised on definitely drinking more, not less.
Right.
And over the years, it's been hard, I think, at times. Mm-hmm. For me to adjust that mindset. But I agree, I want to try more and more. Like, yeah. I know we're going to the cider thing, and those are going to be small pours.
Yeah.
And that's what we're going to do. We're just, you know, my wife's already gone through, I think, the whole list. I printed it out. I formatted it for a three-pager for her, and she's already gone through it. She's been going to websites looking up because some of the names she didn't know.
Okay.
You know, she's excited, right? But she wants to be sort of strategic. Goes, okay. And we're doing the VIP one, so like we're getting a few extra pours out of that. I don't remember what it is, maybe 20 or something.
Right.
But I think it's probably 20 like 2 ounce pours.
Right.
It's almost close to what you're saying.
Yeah.
And so she's excited. She's like, well, okay, well, I could get that here in Michigan, so I don't really want to go there. You know, she's so funny. And she's like figuring that out.
I've tried to plan out when I – especially – I mean, GABF has –
How could you?
Oh my!
There's so much.
This year they were up to I think 750 breweries and like 4,000 different beers. I'm like, all right. So I planned 5 beers that I'm like, all right, we're gonna hit this, 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 and this, and everything else is just kind of like, eh.
Explore.
Yeah,
fun,
like
whatever.
I know that I'm gonna hit Dogfish Head because they have the weirdest things that you can think of. I know I'm gonna hit Sam Adams because they always tap Utopias.
Oh.
Yeah.
You know, I've never gotten to try that.
This is my first year not having it. And I'm like,
oh my God.
Do I want to?
Is your body Jones? Your body's Jones? And you seem like you're twitching a little bit.
Yeah, a little bit. It goes beyond beer and barley wine. To me, I would describe it as almost a port wine. So it's just this.
Sure.
It's this delicious. It's thick, syrupy, like a port wine. But man, it's just delicious. And I'm like, do I want to invest the $200 to buy a bottle?
That's like big people money, isn't it?
Yeah.
When I hear that, I'm like, ooh, wow, that's big people money. Like
$200 for a bottle.
Like you're a married man. So like you'd have to get approval for that. Yeah. You know what I'm saying?
Or I'll save my weekly allowance that I can just spend on whatever I want.
Hold your bottle returns for like a year or something and be like, all right, honey, I held these bottle returns for a year. I'm going to get this at the end of it.
We're in an apartment right now. We don't have anywhere to spend bottles.
Oh, right. Well, you know what? We've been having so much fun sitting here drinking, sampling, talking that we already burned through over an hour. How amazing is that?
Wow, that's amazing. Yeah.
So I want to thank you, Rob, for coming on today. This was a lot of fun drinking some Atwater beers, talking about your background, getting a little different Colorado twist to the show today. I'm really becoming all over the state. I'm just spreading everywhere now with this show. But I want to thank you for coming on episode 20 of the Beer Tour Guy Show. For everyone out there, I got some really cool events coming up on Motor City Brew Tours in the month of February. I'm taking people to the Winter Beer Festival in Grand Rapids on a bus. We're picking up in Royal Oak and Wixom on that, and that is February 23rd, the Saturday.
23rd,
yeah. Yeah, so we're doing it on the Saturday. That's when we go out there on a day trip. I'm also doing a beer history book talk, Detroit Beer History Book Talk at the Detroit Shipping Company on February 27th. I believe that's a Wednesday. And then I also have Feb 16, I have a bus tour where I'm going on the west side, picking up in Royal Oak. I'm taking people to Canton Brew Works, North Center Brewing Company, and Liberty Street Brewing Company. Should be a lot of fun. If you're interested in any of that stuff, Rob included, you should check out MotorCityBrewTours.com, our website, or check us out on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter. I want to thank everybody for listening on the show. I want to thank Better on Draft for being my sponsors and Podcast Detroit for having a kick-ass studio. I want to thank you for listening, and stay tuned next month when we have Baffin Brewing Company on episode 21.
All right,
thanks for listening. Thanks for having me.